My name is, and you are listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM, which is true.
If you like radio that painstakingly stitches together seemingly unlike music in delightfully unpredictable ways, then check out WGXC's Overlooked, the second and fourth Tuesday of each month, just after the new news. You'll hear underheard and overlooked music, ancient to future, from every corner of the Omniverse. That's Overlooked on 90.7 WGXC.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by Upstate Films, a nonprofit theater connecting the Hudson Valley through transformative cinematic experiences in both Rhinebeck and Saugerties. This month, playing I Like It Here, Sinners, Drop Dead City, Art for Everybody, The Uninvited, Jane Austen Wrecked My Life.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, it's 12:02 a.m., second day of June, 2025, and you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, the name of the show, Good Night, Norman. The call letters, WGXC 90.7 FM. Radio for open ears. WGXC.org on the World Wide Web. but if you're listening now, I guess you know all these things already. Tonight, without any editorial ado, Franz Kafka. Title of this story, Jackals and Arabs. We were camping in the oasis. My companions were asleep. An Arab, tall and dressed in white, went past me. He had been tending to his camels and was going to his sleeping place. I threw myself on my back into the grass. I wanted to sleep. I couldn't. The howling of a jackal in the distance. I sat up straight again. And what had been so far away was suddenly close by. A swarming pack of jackals around me. Their eyes flashing dull gold and going out. Slender bodies moving in a quick, coordinated manner, as if responding to a whip. One of them came from behind, pushed himself under my arm, right against me, as if it needed my warmth. Then stepped in front of me and spoke, almost eye to eye with me.
"I'm the oldest jackal for miles around. I'm happy I'm still able to welcome you here. I had already almost given up hope, for we've been waiting for you an infinitely long time. My mother waited, and her mother, and all her mothers, right back to the mother of all jackals. Believe me."
"That surprises me," I said, forgetting to light the pile of wood which lay ready to keep the jackals away with its smoke. "I'm very surprised to hear that. I've come from the high north merely by chance and am in the middle of a short trip. What do you jackals want, then?" As if encouraged by this conversation, which was perhaps too friendly, they drew their circle more closely around me, all panting. snarling. "We know," the oldest began, "that you come from the north. Our hope rests on that very point. In the north, there's a way of understanding things which one cannot find here among the Arabs. You know, from their cool arrogance, one cannot strike a spark of common sense. They kill animals to eat them. They disregard rotting carcasses." "Don't speak so loud," I said. "There are Arabs sleeping close by." "You really are a stranger," said the jackal. "Otherwise you would know that throughout the history of the world, the jackal has never yet feared an Arab. Should we fear them? Is it not misfortune enough that we have been cast out among such peoples?"
Maybe. That could be," I said. "I'm not up to judging things which are so far removed from me. It seems to be a very old conflict. It's probably in the blood, and so perhaps will only end with blood."
"You are very clever," said the old jackal, and they all panted even more quickly, their lungs breathing rapidly, although they were standing still. A bitter smell streamed out of their open jaws. At times I could tolerate it only by clenching my teeth.
"You are very clever. What you said corresponds to our ancient doctrine. So we take their blood, and the quarrel's over."
"Oh," I said more sharply than I intended, "they'll defend themselves. They'll shoot you down in droves with their guns."
"You do not understand us," he said, "a characteristic of human beings which has not disappeared, not even in the high north. We are not going to kill them. The Nile would not have enough water to wash us clean. The very sight of their living bodies makes us run away immediately into cleaner air, into the desert, which, for that very reason, is our home."
All the jackals surrounding us, and in the meantime many more had come up from a distance, lowered their heads between the front legs and cleaned them with their paws, as if they wanted to conceal an aversion which was so terrible that I would have much preferred to take a big jump and escape beyond the circle. So what do you intend to do?" I asked. I wanted to stand up, but I couldn't. Two young animals were holding me firmly from behind with their jaws biting my jacket and shirt. I had to remain sitting.
"They are holding your train," said the old jackal, seriously, by way of explanation. "A mark of respect."
"Well, they should let me go," I cried out, turning back and forth between the old one and the young ones.
"Of course they will," said the old one, "if that's what you want. But it'll take a little while, for, as is our habit, they have dug their teeth in deep and must first let their jaws open gradually. Meanwhile, listen to our request."
"Your conduct has not made me particularly receptive to it," I said.
"Don't make us pay for our clumsiness," he said, and now, for the first time, he brought the plaintive tone of his natural voice to his assistance. "We are poor animals. All we have is our teeth. For everything we want to do, good and bad, the only thing available to us is our teeth."
So what do you want?" I asked, only slightly reassured.
"Sir,"
he cried out, and all the jackals howled. To me it sounded very remotely like a melody.
"Sir, you should end the quarrel which divides the world in two. Our ancestors described a man like you as the one who will do it. We must be free of the Arabs. With air we can breathe, a view of the horizon around us, clear of Arabs, no cries of pain from a sheep which an Arab has knifed, and every animal should die peacefully and be left undisturbed for us to drain it empty and clean it right down to the bones. Cleanliness. That's what we want. Nothing but cleanliness. Now they were all crying and sobbing. How can you bear it in this world? You, noble heart and sweet entrails. Dirt is their white. Dirt is their black. Their beards are horrible. Looking at the corners of their eyes makes one spit. And if they lift their arms, hell opens up in their armpits. And that's why, sir, that's why, my dear sir, with the help of your all-capable hands, you must use these scissors to slit right through their throats. He jerked his head, and in response, a jackal came up carrying on its canine tooth a small pair of sewing scissors covered with old rust. So, finally the scissors. It's time to stop, cried the Arab leader of our caravan, who had crept up on us from downwind. Now he swung his gigantic whip. The jackals all fled quickly, but still remained at some distance, huddled closely together. Many animals so close and stiff that it looked as if they were in a narrow pen with jack-o'-lanterns flying around them. The jackals all fled quickly. Oh, sorry. So, you too, sir, have seen and heard this spectacle, said the Arab, laughing as cheerfully as the reticence of his race permitted. So, you know what the animals want. So you know what the animals want, I asked. Of course, sir, he said. That's common knowledge as long as there are Arabs. These scissors will wander with us through the deserts until the end of days. Every European has offered them for the great work. Every European is exactly the one they think qualified to do it. These animals have an absurd hope. They're idiots, real idiots. That's why we're fond of them. They're our dogs, finer than the ones you have. Now watch this. In the night, a camel died. I've had it brought here. Four bearers came and threw the heavy carcass right in front of us. No sooner was it lying there than the jackals raised their voices. Every one of them crept forward, its body scraping the ground as if drawn by an irresistible rope. They had forgotten the Arabs, forgotten their hatred. The presence of a powerfully stinking dead body wiped out everything and enchanted them. One of them was already hanging at the camel's throat, and with its first bite had found the artery. Like a small angry pup, like a small angry pump which, with a determination matched only by its hopelessness, seeks to put out an overpowering fire, every muscle of its body pulled and twitched in its place. Then, right away, all of them were lying there on the corpse, working in the same way, piled up like a mountain. The leader cracked his sharp whip powerfully all around above them. They raised their heads, half fainting in their intoxicated state, looked at the Arab standing in front of them, started to feel the whip now hitting their muzzles, jumped away and ran back a distance. But the camel's blood was already lying there in pools, stinking to heaven, and the body was torn wide open in several places. They could not resist. They were there again. The leader once more raised his whip. I grabbed his arm. Sir, you're all right, he said. We'll leave them to their calling. Besides, it's time to break camp. You've seen them. Wonderful creatures, aren't they? How they hate us. It's 12:15 in the morning. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, the
Name of the show, Good Night Norman. The name of the station, WGXC, 90.7 FM. Radio for Open Ears, based in Catskill, New York, transmitting from Acra, New York, in lovely, particularly green at this time of year, Green County. Consider donating to WGXC. It'll help sustain us, this radio station, and its community of listeners and programmers, for as long as you care to. Go to the website, wgxc.org, and click donate. There are a host of options. It's 12:16 in the morning of June 2nd. You're listening to Good Night Norman, Franz Kafka special. I haven't read Kafka before, believe it or not, but I'm doing it now. This story is called A Hunger Artist. In the last decades, interest in hunger artists has declined considerably. Whereas in earlier days there was good money to be earned putting on major productions of this sort under one's own management, nowadays that is totally impossible. Those were different times. Back then, the hunger artist captured the attention of the entire city. From day to day, while the fasting lasted, participation increased. Everyone wanted to see the hunger artist at least daily. During the final days, there were people with subscription tickets who sat all day in front of the small barred cage. And there were even viewing hours at night, their impact heightened by torchlight. On fine days, the cage was dragged out into the open air, and then the hunger artist was put on display, particularly for the children. While for grown-ups, the hunger artist was often merely a joke, something they participated in because it was fashionable, the children looked on amazed, their mouths open, holding each other's hands for safety as he sat there on scattered straw, spurning a chair, in black tights, looking pale, with his ribs sticking out prominently, sometimes nodding politely, answering questions with a forced smile, even sticking his arm out through the bars to let people feel how emaciated he was. But then completely sinking back into himself so that he paid no attention to anything, not even to what was so important to him, the striking of the clock, which was the single furnishing in the cage, merely looking out in front of him, with his eyes almost shut, and now and then sipping from a tiny glass of water to moisten his lips. Apart from the changing groups of spectators, there were also constant observers chosen by the public. Strangely enough, they were usually butchers, who, always three at a time, were given the task of observing the hunger artist day and night so that he didn't get something to eat in some secret manner. It was, however, merely a formality introduced to reassure the masses, for those who understood knew well enough that during the period of fasting, the hunger artist would never, under any circumstances, have eaten the slightest thing, not even if compelled by force. The honor of his art forbade it. Naturally, none of the watchers understood that. Sometimes there were nightly groups of watchers who carried out their vigil very laxly, deliberately sitting together in a distant corner and putting all their attention into playing cards there, clearly intending to allow the hunger artist a small refreshment which, according to their way of thinking, he could get from some secret supplies. Nothing was more excruciating to the hunger artist than such watchers. They depressed him. They made his fasting terribly difficult. Sometimes he overcame his weakness and sang during the time they were observing, for as long as he could keep it up, just to show people how unjust their suspicions about him were. That was little help, For then they just wondered among themselves about his skill at being able to eat even while singing. He much preferred the observers who sat down right against the bars and, not satisfied with the dim backlighting of the room, illuminated him with electric flashlights. The glaring light didn't bother him in the slightest. Generally, he couldn't sleep at all, and he could always doze under any lighting and at any hour, even in an overcrowded, noisy auditorium. With such observers, he was very happily prepared to spend the entire night without sleeping. He was very pleased to joke with them, to recount stories from his nomadic life, and then, in turn, to listen to their stories, doing everything just to keep them awake, so that he could keep showing them once again that he had nothing to eat in his cage and that he was fasting as none of them could. He was happiest, however, when morning came and a lavished breakfast was brought for them at his expense, on which they hurled themselves with the appetite of healthy men after a hard night's work without sleep. True, there were still people who wanted to see in this breakfast an unfair means of influencing the observers. But that was going too far. And if they were asked whether they wanted to undertake the observers' night shift for its own sake without breakfast, they excused themselves. Nonetheless, they stood by their suspicions. However, it was in general part of fasting that these doubts were inextricably associated with it. For in fact, no one was in a position to spend time watching the hunger artist every day and night, so no one could know, on the basis of his own observation, whether this was a case of truly uninterrupted, flawless fasting. The hunger artist himself was the only one who could know that, and at the same time, the only spectator capable of being completely satisfied with his own fasting. But the reason he was never satisfied was something different. Perhaps it was not fasting at all which made him so very emaciated that many people, to their own regret, had to stay away from his performance because they couldn't bear to look at him. For he was also so skeletal out of dissatisfaction with himself, because he alone knew something that even initiates didn't know, how easy it was to fast. It was the easiest thing in the world. About this, he did not remain silent, but people did not believe him. At best, they thought he was being modest. Most of them, however, believed he was a publicity seeker, or a total swindler, for whom, at all events, fasting was easy because he understood how to make it easy, and then had the nerve to half admit it. He had to accept all that. Over the years, he had become accustomed to it, but this dissatisfaction kept gnawing at his insides all the time, and he never yet, and this one had to say to his credit, had he left the cage of his own free will after any period of fasting. The impresario had set the maximum length of time for the fast at 40 days. He would never allow the fasting to go on beyond that point, not even in the cosmopolitan cities. And in fact, he had a good reason. Experience had shown that for almost 40 days one could increasingly whip up a city's interest by gradually increasing advertising, but that then the people turned away. One could demonstrate a significant decline in popularity. In this respect, there were, of course, small differences among different towns and among different countries, but as a rule it was true that 40 days was the maximum length of time. So then, on the 40th day, the door of the cage, which was covered with flowers, was opened. An enthusiastic audience filled the amphitheater. A military band played. Two doctors entered the cage in order to take the necessary measurements of the hunger artist.
The results were announced to the audience through a megaphone, and finally two young ladies arrived, happy about the fact that they were the ones who had just been selected by lot, seeking to lead the hunger artist down a couple of steps out of the cage, where, on a small table, a carefully chosen hospital meal was laid out. And at this moment, the hunger artist always fought back. Of course, he still freely laid his bony arms in the helpful outstretched hands of the ladies bending over him, but he did not want to stand up. Why stop right now after 40 days? He could have kept going for even longer, for an unlimited length of time. Why stop right now when he was in his best form? Indeed, not yet even in his best fasting form. Why did people want to rob him of the fame of fasting longer? Not just so that he could become the greatest hunger artist of all time, which he probably was already, but also so that he could surpass himself in some unimaginable way. For he felt there were no limits to his capacity for fasting. Why did this crowd, which pretended to admire him so much, have so little patience with him? If he kept going and kept fasting longer, why would they not tolerate it? Then, too, he was tired and felt good sitting in the straw. Now he was supposed to stand up straight and tall and go to eat, something which, when he just imagined it, made him feel nauseous right away. With great difficulty, he repressed mentioning this only out of consideration for the women. And he looked up into the eyes of these women, apparently so friendly, but in reality so cruel, and shook his excessively heavy head on his feeble neck. Then happened what always happened. The impresario came in, and in silence, the music made talking impossible, raised his arms over the hunger artist as if inviting heaven to look upon its work here on the straw, this unfortunate martyr, something the hunger artist certainly was, only in a completely different sense. Then grabbed the hunger artist around his thin waist in the process, wanting with his exaggerated caution to make people believe that here he had to deal with something fragile, and handed him over, not without secretly shaking him a little so that the hunger artist's legs and upper body swung back and forth uncontrollably, to the women, who had in the meantime turned as pale as death. At this point, the hunger artist endured everything. His head lay on his chest. It was as if it had inexplicably rolled around and just stopped there. His body was arched back. His legs, in an impulse of self-preservation, pressed themselves together at the knees but scraped the ground, as if they were not really on the floor but were looking for the real ground, and the entire weight of his body, admittedly very small, lay against one of the women, who appealed for help with flustered breath, for she had not imagined her post of honor would be like this, and then stretched her neck as far as possible to keep her face from the least contact with the hunger artist. But then, when she couldn't manage this, and her more fortunate companion didn't come to her assistance, but trembled and remained content to hold in front of her the hunger artist's hand, that small bundle of knuckles, she broke into tears, to the delighted laughter of the auditorium, and had to be relieved by an attendant who had been standing ready for some time. Then came the meal. The impresario put a little food into the mouth of the hunger artist, now half unconscious, as if fainting, and kept up a cheerful patter designed to divert attention away from the hunger artist's condition. Then a toast was proposed to the public, which was supposedly whispered to the impresario by the hunger artist. The orchestra confirmed everything with a great fanfare. People dispersed, and no one had the right to be dissatisfied with the event. No one except the hunger artist. He was always the only one. He lived this way. He lived this way, taking small, regular breaks for many years, apparently in the spotlight, honored by the world. But for all that, his mood was usually gloomy, and it kept growing gloomier all the time. Because no one understood how to take him seriously. But how was he to find consolation? What was there left for him to wish for? And if a good-natured man who felt sorry for him ever wanted to explain to him that his sadness probably came from his fasting, then it could happen that the hunger artist responded with an outburst of rage and began to shake the bars like an animal, frightening everyone. But the impresario had a way of punishing moments like this, something he was happy to use. He would make an apology for the hunger artist to the assembled public, conceding that the irritability had been provoked only by his fasting, something quite intelligible to well-fed people, and capable of excusing the behavior of the hunger artist without further explanation. From there, he would move on to speak about the equally hard-to-understand claim of the hunger artist that he could go on fasting for much longer than he was doing. He would praise the lofty striving, the goodwill, and the great self-denial no doubt contained in this claim, but then would try to contradict it simply by producing photographs, which were also on sale. For in the pictures, one could see the hunger artist on the 40th day of his fast in bed, almost dead from exhaustion. Although the hunger artist was very familiar with this perversion of the truth, it always strained his nerves again and was too much for him. What was the result of the premature ending of the fast people were now proposing as its cause? It was impossible to fight against this lack of understanding, against this world of misunderstanding. In good faith, he always listened eagerly to the impresario at the bars of his cage, but each time, once the photographs came out, he would let go of the bars and, with a sigh, sink back into the straw, and a reassured public could come up again and view him. When those who had witnessed such scenes thought back on them a few years later, often they were unable to understand themselves. For in the meantime, that change mentioned above had set in. It happened almost immediately. There may have been more profound reasons for it, but who bothered to discover what they were? At any rate, one day, the pampered hunger artist saw himself abandoned by the crowd of pleasure seekers who preferred to stream to other attractions. The impresario chased around half of Europe one more time with him to see whether he could still rediscover the old interest here and there. It was all futile. It was as if a secret agreement against the fasting performances had developed somewhere. Naturally, it couldn't really have happened all at once, and people later remembered some things which, in the days of intoxicating success, they hadn't paid sufficient attention to, some inadequately suppressed indicators. But now it was too late to do anything to counter them. Of course, it was certain that the popularity of fasting would return once more someday. But for those now alive, that was no consolation. What was the hunger artist to do now?
a man whom thousands of people had cheered on, could not display himself in show booths at small fun fairs. The hunger artist was not only too old to take up a different profession, but was fanatically devoted to fasting more than anything else. So he said farewell to the impresario, an incomparable companion on his life's road, and let himself be hired by a large circus. In order to spare his own feelings, he didn't even look back at the terms of his contract at all. A large circus, with its huge number of men, animals, and gimmicks, which are constantly being let go and replenished, can use anyone at any time, even a hunger artist, provided, of course, his demands are modest. Moreover, in this particular case, it was not only the hunger artist himself who was engaged, but also his old and famous name. In fact, given the characteristic nature of his act, which was not diminished by his advancing age, one could never claim that a worn-out artist who no longer stood at the pinnacle of his abilities wanted to escape to a quiet position in the circus. On the contrary, the hunger artist had declared that he could fast just as well as in earlier times. Something that was entirely credible. He even affirmed that if people would let him do what he wanted, and he was promised this without further ado, he could really now legitimately amaze the world for the first time, an assertion which, however, given the mood of the time, which the hunger artist and the enthusiasm overlooked, only brought smiles from the experts. However, basically, the hunger artist had not forgotten his sense of the way things really were, and he took it as self-evident that people would not set him and his cage up as the star attraction somewhere in the middle of the arena, but would move him outside in some other readily accessible spot near the animal cafe. Near the animal stalls. Why do they think there would be an animal cafe? Sorry, Mr. Kafka and listeners. Huge, brightly painted signs surrounded the cage and announced what there was to look at there. During the intervals in the main performance, when this general public pushed out towards the menagerie in order to see the animals, they could hardly avoid moving past the hunger artist and stopping there a moment. They would perhaps have remained with him longer if those pushing behind in the narrow passageway, who did not understand this pause on the way to the animal stalls, had not made a longer peaceful observation impossible. This was also the reason why the hunger artist began to tremble at these visiting hours, which he naturally used to long for as the main purpose of his life. In the early days, he could hardly wait for the pauses to the performances. He had looked forward with delight to the crowd pouring around him, until he became convinced only too quickly, and even the most stubborn, almost deliberate self-deception could not hold out against the experience that, judging by their intentions, most of these people were, again and again, without exception, only visiting managers. This view from a distance still remained his most beautiful moment. For when they had come right up to him, he immediately got an earful from the shouting of the two steadily increasing groups. The ones who wanted to take their time looking at the hunger artist, not with any understanding, but on a whim or from mere defiance. For him, these ones were soon the most painful. And a second group of people whose only demand was to go straight to the animal's stalls. Whoa, it's 12:40. You're listening to The Hunger Artist, read by Norman Douglas, your host on Goodnight Norman, from the collected works of Franz Kafka, who wrote this story. Once the large crowds had passed, the latecomers would arrive, and although there was nothing preventing these people anymore from sticking around for as long as they wanted, they rushed past with long strides, almost without a sideways glance to get to the animals in time. And it was an all too rare stroke of luck when the father of a family came by with his children, pointed his finger at the hunger artist, gave a little detailed explanation about what was going on here, and talked of earlier years when he had been present at similar but incomparably more magnificent performances than the children because they had been inadequately prepared at school and in life, always stood around still uncomprehendingly. What was fascinating to them? Nonetheless, the brightness of the book in their searching eyes revealed something of new and more precious times coming. Perhaps, the hunger artist said to himself sometimes, everything would be a little better if his location were not quite so near around the animal stalls. That's why it would be easy for people to make their choice, to say nothing of the fact that he was very upset and constantly depressed by the stink from the stalls, the animals' commotion at night, the places of ear, the pieces of raw meat dragged past for the carnivorous beasts, the roars at feeding time. But he did not dare to approach the administration about it. In any case, he had the animals to thank for the crowds of visitors, among whom here and there could be no one destined for him. And who knew where they would hide him if he wished to remind them of his existence, and along with that, of the fact that, strictly speaking, he was only an obstacle on the way to the menagerie. A small obstacle, at any rate, a constantly diminishing obstacle. People get used to the strange notion that in these times they would want to pay attention to a hunger artist, and with this habitual awareness, the judgment on him was pronounced. He might fast as well as he could, and he did, but nothing could save him anymore. People went straight past him, try to explain the art of fasting to anyone. If someone doesn't feel it, then he cannot be made to understand it. The beautiful signs became dirty and illegible. People tore them down, and no one thought of replacing them. The small table with the number of toys the fasting had lasted, while early on had been carefully renewed, every day, remained unchanged for a long time, for after the first weeks, the staff grew tired of even this small task. So the hunger artist kept fasting on and on, as he once had dreamed about, and he had no difficulty succeeding in achieving what he had predicted back then. But no one was counting the days. No one, not even the hunger artist himself, knew how to
how great his achievement was by this point, and his heart grew heavy. And when once in a while a person strolling past stood making fun of the old number and talking of a swindle, that was, in a sense, to disappoint my... Oh, I just lost the page. Many days went by once more. This, too, came to an end. Finally, the cage caught the attention of a supervisor, and he asked the attendant why they had left this perfectly useful cage standing here unused with rotting straw inside. Nobody knew, until one man, with the help of the table with the number on it, remembered the hunger artist. They pushed the straw around with a pole and found the hunger artist in there. "Are you still fasting?" the supervisor asked. "When are you finally going to get up?" "Forgive me everything," whispered the hunger artist. Only the supervisor, who was pressing his ear up against the cage, understood. "Certainly," said the supervisor, tapping his forehead with his finger in order to indicate to the spectators the state the hunger artist was in. "We forgive you." "I always wanted you to admire my fasting," said the hunger artist. "But we do admire it," said the supervisor obligingly. "But you shouldn't admire it," said the hunger artist. "Well, then, we don't admire it," said the supervisor. "But why shouldn't we admire it?" "Because I had to fast. I can't do anything else," said the hunger artist. "Just look at you," said the supervisor. "Why can't you do anything else?" "Because," said the hunger artist, lifting his head a little and with his lips pursed as if for a kiss, speaking right into the supervisor's ears so that he wouldn't miss anything. "Because I couldn't find food which I enjoyed. If I had found that, believe me, I would not now have made a spectacle of myself and would have eaten to my heart's content, like you and everyone else." Those were his last words. But in his failing eyes, there was the firm, if no longer proud, connection that he was continuing to fast. "All right, tidy this up now," said the supervisor, and they buried the hunger artist along with the straw. But in his cage, they put a young panther. Even for a person with the dullest mind, it was clearly refreshing to see this wild animal throwing itself around in the cage, which had been dreary for such a long time. It lacked nothing. Without thinking about it for any length of time, the guards brought the animal food. It enjoyed the taste and never seemed to miss its freedom. This noble body, equipped with everything necessary, almost to the point of bursting, also appeared to carry freedom around with it. That seemed to be located somewhere or other in its teeth, and its joy in living came with such strong passion from its throat that it was not easy for spectators new to keep watching. But they controlled themselves, kept pressing around the rage with no desire to move on. That's a famous story, The Hunger Artist, by the famous writer Franz Kafka. All right. Let's see, I think there's time for another short one.
This one also by Mr. Franz Kafka. The title is An Imperial Message. The Emperor, so they say, has sent a message directly from his deathbed to you alone, his pathetic subject, a tiny shadow which has taken refuge at the furthest distance from the Imperial Sun. He ordered the herald to kneel down beside his bed and whispered this strange message in his ear. He thought it was so important that he had the herald speak it back to him. He confirmed the accuracy of verbal message by nodding his head. And in front of the entire crowd of those witnessing his death, all the obstructing walls had been broken down, all the great ones of his empire standing in a circle on the broad and high soaring flights of stair. In front of all of them, he dispatched his herald. The messenger started off at once, a powerful, tireless man, sticking one arm out and then another. He makes his way through the crowd. If he runs into resistance, he points to his breast, where there is a tuft of hair. Never will he win his way through. And if he did, nothing would have been achieved. He would have to fight his way down the steps, and if he managed to do that, nothing would have been achieved. He would have to stride through the courtyards, and after the courtyards, through the second palace encircling the first, and then again through stairs and courtyards and flee. And then, once again, a palace. And so for thousands of years. And if he finally burst through the outermost door, but that can never, never happen, the royal capital city, the entire center of the world, is still there and in front of him. All those still there in front of him, piled high and full of sediment. No one pushes his way through here, certainly not someone with a message from a dead man, but you sit at your window and dream of that message when it comes. You're listening to your host, Norman Douglas, read to you from the Complete Franz Kafka, they say. I don't know what they mean by complete. They'll probably discover another one any minute. The new complete. Okay. There's some good and short ones here, but I don't know how short. Okay, you're listening to WGXC. Radio for open ears. WGXC 90.7 FM, WGXC.org on the World Wide Web. Consider donating to WGXC. Pay a visit to the shop on Catskill or the Wave Farm out in Acre. WGXC is your community radio. If you are in the community, and I guess since that's a worldwide community based on the web, if you're in the community next week, send me, well, it'll be 2 weeks from now, send me, you can text me a message about what you think I should read. And maybe I'll do it. Keep reaching for this thing, but it's not gonna happen. Well, Okay, this is one by Franz Kafka called Up in the Gallery. If some frail tubercular lady circus rider were to be driven in circles around and around the arena for months and months without interruption in front of a tireless public on a swaying horse by a merciless, whip-wielding master of ceremonies, spinning the horse, throwing kisses, and swaying at the waist. And if this performance amid the incessant roar of the orchestra and the ventilators were to continue into the ever-expanding gray future, accompanied by explosions which died down and then swelled up again from hands which were really... hammers. Maybe then a young visitor to the gallery might rush down the long staircase through all the levels, burst into the ring, and cry stop through the fanfares of the constantly adjusting orchestra. But since things are not like that, since a beautiful woman in white and red flies in through curtains which proud men in livery open in front of her, since the director, devotedly seeking her eyes, breathes in her decision, in her direction, behaving like an animal, and, as a precaution, lifts her up on the dapple gray horse, as if she were his granddaughter, the one he loved more than anything else, as she starts a dangerous journey. But he cannot decide to give the signal with his whip, and finally, controlling himself, gives it a crack, runs right beside the horse with his mouthy open, follows the rider's leaps with a sharp gaze hardly capable of comprehending her skill, tries to warn her by calling out in English, furiously castigating the grooms, holding hoops, telling them to pay the most scrupulous attention, and begs the orchestra, with upraised arms, to be quiet before the great jump, finally lifts the small woman down from the trembling horse, kisses her on both cheeks, considers no public tribute adequate, while she herself, leaning on him, high on the tips of her toes, with dust swirling around her, arms outstretched and head thrown back, she wants to share her luck with the entire circus. Once, since this is how things are, the visitor to the gallery puts his face on the railing, making the final match, as if into a difficult dream, weeping without realizing it. You've been listening to Goodnight Norman on WGXC, Radio for Open Ears, special Franz Kafka edition. In 2 weeks, I return the night of the 15th, the morning of the 16th, at midnight. Good night, Norman. Old fiction, all the time. Tune in, turn on, and snooze out. Also make that pledge. Go to the website, wgxc.org. Go to the website, donate your credit card.